there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical discussion, healthcare and science in the news, debate, dialogue, and answers to your questions, either by email or live here on the air. Before we go any further, let me remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. And the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. And all of that being said, let me say it's good to be home, and I am still trying to shake the dust, and probably mercury and heavy metal-laden dust of China off my heels, and get back into this beautiful part of the California coast where I live. I had a really interesting personal experience with jet lag and just sort of coming out of that, rather like coming out of a long, dark tunnel. Thank goodness starting to recover today, but it's quite interesting to work on, well, let's just say a lower than typical component of brain cells. I think I've got them all back now, though, so I want to invite you to give me a call. It's a free topic program today, and I would love to hear from you. And I'm interested in getting a sense for what people think about this kind of game that's being played with the town hall meetings, which are apparently not any longer town hall meetings to inform legislatures about healthcare, but are instead Bush campaign stop style put-up jobs where the people who are actually in the pay of lobby groups are showing up and purporting to be citizens and explaining how much we love our current healthcare system and how we don't want the government messing it up. Yeah, right. And apparently the government is actually, or at least members of the government who have their own special interests involved, I'm sure, are buying this or pretending to buy it. So has anybody else caught the wind of this, or is this old news? Other interesting thing that I ran into in the airport in Shanghai was a little video about H1N1 flu. It had a couple of little cartoon pigs talking about how to prevent the flu and what to do if you get the flu. And you'll be interested in knowing that the H1N1 flu comes from America. And it was quite the too bad, so sad, those terrible Americans for sending us the flu to China. I did not get quarantined. I was a little bit worried about that, as some people traveling to China that week, at least, who were close to someone with a fever on the airplane were actually being contacted. And they did make us all fill out a contact sheet where we would be in case someone came down with the flu. They were going to attempt contact tracing and localization, which in China, given the level of control they have over the tourist industry, you might actually successfully be able to do. Well, in any event, they didn't rope me in, I'm happy to say, and it all went swimmingly. While we're on the subject of H1N1 flu, and I hope you're not too sick of the subject, it's turning out to be, one might have anticipated, it's spreading faster than we would have expected over the summer because, hey, it started in the spring and it is a novel flu. So we are seeing it spread through the population more rapidly because there's less immunity. And typically, flu doesn't spread a lot because the virus really doesn't like to be in high heat and tends not to spread or persist well in the environment. But if you have no immunity whatsoever, it doesn't take as large a dose of virus to get sick, and you can carry the water, so to speak, or carry the virus and spread it to others. As of Friday, there were 40,000 laboratory-confirmed cases of the virus and about 4,800 hospitalizations. The vaccine, we got our first report at the office about that. What we know about the vaccine is that there's actually two vaccines. The regular standard flu vaccine will have an H1N1, and they're working on a second vaccine that I think they'll pull out in the event of a major epidemic this fall that will just be an H1N1 that has somewhat different antigenic properties. the regular flu vaccine that will be available to the general population will also have, I believe it's an H3N2, which is the virus that is sort of coming in the regular rotation out of Asia as they generally do. And so they're preparing for a blow from the right or a blow from the left, so to speak. We had an off-air question wondering if people with stronger immune systems are more susceptible to the flu. And actually, they're not more susceptible to the flu, but the immune system reaction to a novel virus is so extreme that they become sicker and are more likely to die than you would anticipate, which is paradoxical because in general, in a flu epidemic, the people with the strongest immune systems get the least sick. But that's because their immune systems have seen the flu before. With a novel flu, the immune system gets so excited and so stimulated by this novel invader that it overreacts, and it's the overreaction of the immune system that can lead to basically something resembling adult respiratory distress syndrome and a thing called a cytokine storm, very similar to what happens with bacterial sepsis. So in fact, it's the toxins that our own body releases in response to what it interprets as a toxin in the case of the flu that lead to massive frustration and death. So we're all hoping very much that the H1N1 doesn't create a sort of 1918 flu epidemic type picture, but it's in everyone's mind that that is a possibility, and that's what's making the CDC and the World Health Organization so nervous. I'm hoping that everybody gets a case of H1N1 mildly this winter and becomes immune and it is no longer a threat. So I'm going for the we all get a little bit sick scenario. And let's go now to Kay in Preston, California. Hello, Kay, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don. Hello. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You've been very much missed by all of us.
Well, thank you very much.
I have a question. I have varied opinions on the risks of having hiatal hernia surgery, and I wondered what your opinion is of that surgery.
Are we talking about the laparoscopic surgery?
Well, that's what I was initially told by one doctor and then another one who said, if you were my sister, I'd tell you never do this. It's very risky. And so I originally thought it would be laparoscopic. I haven't talked to the surgeon yet. I want his opinion, but I was curious what you thought of it.
Okay. I don't see laparoscopic surgery in general as being an ordeal. The small incisions make the recovery very quick, and I am unaware of a large number of surgical complications from either the laparoscopic or the open procedure, but the open procedure, you have a larger abdominal incision, and it's harder to recover from.
Right.
In general, there is about a 1 in 10,000 rate of significant surgical complication related to anesthesia or intraoperative pneumonia or reaction to the drugs or things like that. So that's a kind of aggressive estimate. So, you know, I've talked to anesthesiologists who say that's too high and we should be using, quoting, 1 in 50,000. But I think the 1 in 10,000 figure allows for all the sort of random stuff that the universe can throw at you and, you know, just says, well, if you have surgery, you're entering into a machine which works, you know, 9,999 out of 10,000 times, and then it doesn't work rather badly in that one case. So those are good odds.
Very good odds.
Now, in terms of getting the surgery, it doesn't last forever. We're talking about a Nissen fundoplication, which is pulling the stomach down back under the diaphragm and kind of stitching it in place and making a little fold at the top of the stomach to act as a secondary valve. And those do stretch out. And so a lot of times hiatal hernias will recur, say, you know, 5 to 10 years after the surgery, you can check and find that the hiatal hernia is coming back or comes back completely. How significant are your symptoms? What, in other words, are you benefiting from by having the surgery?
Well, I have ongoing pain in my chest area. And my OBGYN, who, as he says, treats the whole body, not just gynecological needs, he feels that that is what is causing the problem. So he thinks I should have the surgery.
I'm sorry, say that again?
My OBGYN has recommended that I have the surgery due to a lot of chest pain, pain around the heart. I've had a full workup with the heart. Doesn't seem to be a problem. Oh. So he thinks a hiatal hernia is causing this this distress.
I think you need a second opinion.
Okay.
That worries me a little bit. That's not a definitive diagnosis, and also a lot of people with hiatal hernias are completely asymptomatic, and a lot of people have chest pain for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a second opinion from a gastroenterologist, preferably, because they don't do the surgery.
Right.
And therefore, they have absolutely no incentive to tell you you need surgery when you don't.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
There's something called a pH monitor that you can swallow, and basically it's a little pH sensor or tube that sits at the top of your esophagus and measures how much acid you're poking up. Plus, the gastroenterologist can take a look down in your esophagus and see if indeed it looks like you're having a lot of acid reflux. Sometimes that creates a precancerous condition, and those are the situations where I generally would urge someone to have surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Cutting in order to treat pain, not a good idea. One thing that you could do as a test of your OBGYN's opinion, just to be fair, would be go down to the pharmacy and buy some over-the-counter omeprazole. Brand name is Prilosec. This is a PPI, proton pump inhibitor. It blocks mm-hmm. all of the acid in your stomach.
Right.
And go ahead and block all the acid in your stomach for 10 days and see what happens to your symptoms.
Oh, okay.
And if your symptoms continue, then I think they may have another cause than the hiatal hernia.
Okay, well, that's a very good suggestion. I'll give that a try.
And I think a second opinion is called for here.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much, Dr.
Thank you
Don.
For the call. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Steve in Pacific Grove. Hello, Steve, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, Dr. Don. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I have just returned from a trip to Vietnam and had an interesting experience in the airport where there they were screening everybody with a thermograph
right.
as you walked in so that they, and I was watching them do this, so they were seeing anybody that had their sinuses light up or their chest light up, they were pulling them aside and they were definitely quarantining them. And they had a few people there, and what was disturbing to me was I was realizing, hey, I was just on a plane with these people. And so it had me wondering if there's that much concern, shouldn't they be screening at the entry points of the plane rather than the exit point to a single country?
Well, you're talking about what would be intelligent and practical as opposed to what's politically possible. And I think the issue really is exactly that. It's a practical issue because obviously it makes a lot more sense not to expose everybody else on the airplane if someone's sick and make essentially good health in the absence of a fever a condition for getting on the airplane. And then maybe in a serious epidemic, really what we should be doing is screening at both ends because people could develop their fever, especially on a transcontinental flight or a transoceanic flight. You got 12 hours. That's plenty of time to go from being pre-sick to being sick, particularly in an influenza or where this was initially tried, which was during the SARS epidemic back in the early 2000s. SARS never really got any foothold, but that was a very severe sudden respiratory distress syndrome and much, much nastier than the flu. But fortunately, it also didn't seem to be as contagious. But there were definitely thermograms being done on people. I suspect I had a thermogram as I got off the airplane. I just didn't see it happening, and I didn't see anyone being pulled aside. But we had an extremely long corridor to walk down, and I'm pretty sure that we were screened on that would have been pulled off during our long, long walk down that corridor very subtly. And possibly some people were. I didn't see it happen, so I can't be sure it did. But I'm also pretty sure that the Chinese will be sneaky about it, as opposed to maybe the Vietnamese who have more direct approach.
Yeah, they were just right at the gate as you were just getting off the plane. It was quite in the open. I had one more question about H1N1. And by the way, I'm an RN and a former AIDS nurse, an ICU nurse and ER nurse. So
yes.
I've been around infectious disease. When the H1N1 virus was first announced, quite horrifyingly to me, they said they were talking about it as being genetically a combination of bird flu and swine flu, and then that just kind of disappeared. Was that because it was swept aside or because that just proved untrue?
Well, it really is a genetic chimera, and so it has components of human flus, swine flus, and bird flus all together, but I think many viruses do. So it turned out to be more complicated than that. Calling it a swine flu was kind of a simplification, but it does contain elements of all three dominant types of influenza.
I see. So, I mean, making it therefore possible to just simultaneously, continuously exist in all three reservoirs.
Yes, and the question is, it's a different virus in the pigs and a different virus in the birds. The H1N1 are just antigen types,
right,
which are just two of the many genes carried in the viruses. I mean, standardly in birds, it is H1N1 that birds get. That's the most common bird flu. And
right,
the thing is, it doesn't contain the genes that allow it to get into human cells. And then it did. That was the thing with bird flu in Asia a few years back, was that people could get it from their birds. And so poultry farmers and people exposed to birds were the ones who got it. But there was very, very little, if any, human-to-human transmission. And those cases that were human-to-human worried people very, very much. So it's more about the facility or the ease. You never say never. With bird flu, it could get into humans, but it rarely did. And it did, we think, in several cases, pass from massively infected children to family members. But it didn't get traction. And in the case, right, in the case of the one that started, we believe, in Mexico, it was originally thought to have maybe come out of a big pig factory farm. And the people in the town around that farm had gotten an influenza-like illness. And I'm not sure if that idea panned out or not, but initially that was thought to be the source. Of course, as it passes from human to human, it recombines again and again, and the genes keep shifting. So it becomes a moving target. And one of the reasons that we use the H1N1 system and use that for our vaccines is because those are relatively conserved proteins, and so they don't change nearly as quickly as all the other proteins in those flu viruses, which mutate quite a lot.
Just a final comment, then I'll let you go. Traveling in Vietnam, the duck population is resuscitating since the massive kill-off they had to do. And I was just amazed because I traveled in some quite rural areas where you see duck farms that are big there. You see them all over the place. And, yep, you just have children running around playing with the ducks. And it wasn't hard for me to imagine how bird viruses were passing to humans. So, my thought was, yeah, and I hope that issue of birds and the closeness of human and poultry contact there has changed at all.
Right. No, of course, and it wouldn't, because it's deeply embedded in the culture. Cultural change is very difficult.
Right.
Good
luck getting over your...
My jet lag?
Yeah, it took me a good full 10 days. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it's taking this long. I guess it just comes with a little bit of age.
Don't use the A word around me right now, please.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We are now going to take just a moment before we go to our next caller. I want to tell you about a new treatment that I read about. This was published in the British Journal of Dermatology, and it's a treatment for eczema using vitamin B12. And a patient came into my office and asked me if I'd heard about this, and I hadn't, and went and looked it up. And it's indeed a legitimate study. This was a placebo-controlled study, and it was looking at people with severe eczema. They used a cream that had 0.07% B12, cyanocobalamin. It was a placebo study. The cream was applied twice a day for 8 weeks, and then they looked at the severity and the extent of the eczema on the two sides. The putative mechanism for why B12 might act as an anti-inflammatory is that it inhibits the production of inflammatory cytokines and actually traps nitric oxide, which is a cellular signal produced by cell. So it's kind of a free radical sink. We have some other very powerful pharmaceuticals that were introduced a few years back. Tacrolimus, or Protopic, was a... Well, essentially an immune system suppression. It worked very well to help with eczema. And we thought, oh, great, we don't have to use those scary and somewhat dangerous steroids on children anymore. And then some of those children turned out to have higher rates of leukemia and particularly skin lymphomas. And it looks like maybe it suppresses the immune system enough to actually allow for the development of cancer. So that's gotten, well, let's just say, begun to be used a lot more cautiously after that side effect emerged. Directly messing with the immune system, probably a bad idea in general. And I think whenever you take a significant amount of immune suppression for, let's say, multiple sclerosis or inflammatory bowel disease, you are probably running a cancer risk. And at this point, the drugs are too new for us to quantify the cancer risk, but it's very plausible that you would be, and the data is definitely supporting that you are. So we know there's an increased risk. We haven't quantified it yet. Be very cautious with immune suppressions. Use it when you really are quite ill and at significant risk from the disease. That's really where those drugs belong. Not widespread use, certainly not yet, until we can quantify those risks more accurately. So B12, topical for eczema, sounds like a good idea. And you can get that at your friendly neighborhood compounding pharmacy. Let's go to Hillary in Boulder Creek. Hello, Hillary, and thanks for holding.
Thanks for taking my call, and welcome home.
Oh, thanks.
So I've been having some breakthrough depression, and I've seen advertisements for Abilify. One of the side effects they talk about on television is trigeminal neuralgia, which no one needs. I wondered if you could talk about that drug.
Abilify is a very new drug, and it's being advertised on TV, which I think is just nuts. I'm concerned about its use, and I'm concerned because there are some long-term neurological things that can occur when you use these atypical antipsychotics, and it's actually in that class. It's not an antidepressant. It's not an ADD drug. It's being offered to people with depression and ADD, and it's the bright new shiny tool in the toolbox. But I don't really like the use of the drug for anything but refractory psychoactive semi-psychotic states where you've got, just like I was saying with the immune suppressions, you've got a real problem to treat, and taking a risk of side effects is a legitimate thing to do. So what are we treating with this? Depression? Plain old out-of-the-box depression, I would tend to treat with one of the drugs that we've had for, 20 years or so, something in the SSRI category. At least we know, that's the devil we know, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And you should start with that because the side effects and risks of that are not so great. So I would not ever start with Abilify for something that could be treated with also much less expensive drugs, if you consider that a factor. I like to consider also just how long has it been around, what do we know about its long-term side effects and its effectiveness, because it doesn't have a track record in depression, really.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate your call. Thanks for asking, and have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. And let's talk to Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm still a little jet-lagged, but doing fine.
Do you use melatonin at all?
You know, I tried that the other night, and I had some lovely and vivid dreams, which I had heard was a side effect and hadn't experienced personally before. So, that part, I'm sleeping okay. The problem is I'm wanting to do it at 2 in the afternoon as well as at 11 at night.
So it's just a matter of timing.
Yes. It's more along the lines of, basically, I know what's going on here is that my body clock is messed up, and so I'm releasing my own melatonin at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm doing all the things you're supposed to do, getting sunlight in my eyes in the early morning and getting into the dark as soon as possible in the evening and, you know, forcing a sleep at the appropriate time. And, you know, the 2 in the afternoon physiologic downs are fading, but it's like a stroll down memory lane. I feel like I'm back in residency doing those 36-hour shifts all over again. Except I'm not.
So your trip to China made you feel younger.
Yes, that's one way of looking at it.
That's And on the last caller, she was talking about, hello?
Abilify, yes.
Abilify. I was diagnosed with clinical depression, and I was disabled by it, and I had, you know, quite a bit of problems, and it took me years, varieties of different medications that they gave me, you know, pharmaceutical, psychological drugs.
Mm-hmm. And eventually you recovered.
No, I never recovered, but what I did was I got off of the pharmaceuticals and started taking something called theanine serine with Relora. It's got GABA in it, mm-hmm. and it's got theanine.
Mm-hmm. Theanine is a compound that's found in green tea. It's relaxing and calming quality. I'm not sure what the... You said Allura?
Relora.
Relora, yeah. I'm not...
It's a proprietary blend of patented extract from... Yeah, if I can read this word.
Yeah, that's
magnolia?
Magnolia, okay. So it's a... Magnolia is another herb or, you know, plant compound and has a very long history in China. Actually, it's part of the Chinese pharmacopoeia for calming sleep disorders, irritability, things like that, anxiety. So,
yeah, I have anxiety tacked on to the depression.
Yeah, that's really fun, isn't it? So you're both overstimulated and
yeah, I wake up in the morning and on the run. I don't even need coffee, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Ready to go. And then I fall asleep in the middle of the day, and then I get like these depressions. But anyway, what I'm trying to say here is that I'm taking this combination, the theanine and the serine.
Right.
And it's got some holy basil in there. I don't know if that matters. And it's got GABA, 5-HTP. And also I do a lot of omega 3, 6, and 9. I find that really helps.
Yes, there's good literature supporting the use of high dose, particularly DHA, which is deoxyhexanoic acid. That's the omega 3 component that makes up a large percentage of the cell walls in our brain cells.
Yeah.
And so making your brain cells work better, making them more fluid so that the neurotransmitters are able to do their thing more readily seems to really help a lot of the time with depression. The use of natural agents, I think, particularly in combination, is an intriguing topic because all of our science, when we do science, we typically are doing it on a single agent. And that comes from a tradition of trying to be very analytical about how we test things. And the drawback to such science is that, in general, plant products are milder than pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
And tend to work better in combinations. In other words, synergistic combinations. When you think about spicing a dish, generally cooking works better when you use multiple spices rather than just have one dominant note. And herbal medicine is a little bit like cooking with herbs.
So
it tends to work better when you have multiple components. But the problem, of course, with multiple components is they're difficult to test scientifically. So our literature has never really caught up with particularly the over-the-counter herbal, quote-unquote, food supplements, which that's such a joke because they're regulated as food supplements. Therefore, they can't make any health claims, which means you really can't figure out what you're supposed to be taking at the health food store. It may assist with the immune system. It's like, okay, what does that mean? You know, am I supposed to take it for autoimmune disease or am I supposed to take it because I've got Lyme disease? You know, you can't tell. And they're not really able to make any kinds of specific claims. And furthermore, they're not required to back them up with science, and the science isn't there. A lot of the times it hasn't even been conceived of because they haven't looked at these multifactorial combinations particularly well. I'm glad that you found something that is working for you and helping you with your symptoms.
I've changed my diet as well. The amount of sugar that I eat and high calorie carbohydrates, those kinds of things I've eliminated from my diet. And I do a regular, they have this tea that you can get at the store that will give you a cleansing of your liver.
Right.
And I was reading in Chinese medicine that they find that the liver is the chi for anger.
That's right.
And, you know, right. Being upset and those kinds of things. And if you keep that clear, so I'm thinking, you know, like, well, alcoholics are always bitter and, you know, like acting up, and that affects the liver. And mm-hmm. if I clear my liver, maybe I won't have that feeling. And sure enough, I don't get that anger feeling. I don't get that, you know, like where I feel like, you know, like if I go up to a checkout counter and they get the change wrong or something, I would, like, you know, get angry at the person.
Mm-hmm. And that's...
And I obviously that's ridiculous because, you know, they're just working.
Yeah.
So, I don't have that feeling anymore, and it's just from simply keeping my liver clean. You know, that probably sounds kind of ridiculous to the majority of people. What do you mean, keep your liver clean? What are you going to do, pull it out and wash it, you know? But for real, I mean, this is, I don't know how to explain it.
Well, I'm so glad that you've found a good combination of things that are helping you with your problem, and I appreciate your sharing that with the audience. I hope that there are people out there who may try some of the things you've mentioned. You were a case of someone who went the pharmaceutical route and went the counseling route and found it unhelpful. The majority of people do find it helpful, but when it is unhelpful, trying other alternatives is the appropriate step. But I do think, I have to say, that depression is a serious illness and often a lethal one, because the suicide rate in people who become depressed is significant. So it isn't something to try to self-treat. You do need help, and one should avail oneself of what's available, you know, of the standard therapies that work for the majority, and let those fail first, and then move into the alternative realm if they are unsuccessful. I still reach for the Prozac when I encounter someone with a new onset significant depression.
Yeah.
And I let that fail before I get creative with the SAMe or the...
Well, I mean, there's
the omega-3s, or yeah, exactly.
But there's a good half a dozen ones out there today.
Exactly.
Just like the one you mentioned from the caller before.
Right. Well, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. We've got a little time here, so I want to pull some things out of the archives here, and you can hear papers crackling, and that's me messing around with my archives and seeing what we... should talk about. This one's interesting. This is about the flu again, and I know I'm sounding like I've got flu on the brain, and perhaps I do a little bit. As we approach cold and flu season, I am wondering what's in store for us and whether we will have a significant number of people out of commission for a long period of time, which is what severe flu does to you. You know, you can basically count on 10 days offline. And this one is that of the people who have died of this new H1N1, severe obesity turns out to be a major risk factor. And this is something that we haven't seen in regular influenza. This is a small study, only they looked at 10 patients at a Michigan hospital, and these were the 10 sickest people that were in Michigan. And of those, they all had to be put on ventilators, all 10 of them. And 9 of the 10 were obese. In other words, had a body mass index greater than 30. And 7 had a body mass index greater than 40. So they were severely obese. So concerns about whether or not there could be additional risk factor unique to this flu. Pulmonary embolisms were higher. And that may be due to the fact that fat tissue makes a plasminogen inhibitor. And that... plasminogen is what breaks down blood clots when they form spontaneously in your blood. So maybe plasminogen activator inhibitor could be a factor here, that there's more of that. And so something in the influenza virus is increasing blood clots. And then the fact that you're heavy means that you're more likely to form them. That could be why there is a huge increase in risk for very fat people. But certainly as the vaccine comes out, I'm going to include obesity as one of my risk factors for making sure that if I have a limited vaccine, I give that to people who are more likely to die if they get the flu. And that's the immunosuppressed, the people with cancer, the people with diabetes, the elderly, the very young, and now the obese. They're all on my list for getting flu vaccine early. And if you're in one of those categories, get yourself on your doctor's list for that. Let's go now to James in Santa Cruz. Hello, James, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be on.
What can I do for you today?
My wife has had a colonoscopy with irritated colon, and then was put on Asacol.
Asacol, yes.
For about 6 months, and then had a clean colon.
Good.
And the physician said, take it the rest of your life.
I disagree.
Of course, that's why I called you.
Okay.
He was the same physician who said, well, how about Phylosec for the rest of your life? And I know what you think about that.
Right. Well, you never go back to that doctor. You know, you're fixed. But are you? And the drug is not really a bad drug. Acicol is an anti-inflammatory. It's in the category, it's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. Doesn't get really absorbed into the bloodstream. Not a lot of systemic side effects. Not a lot of risks associated with it. So it's not an immune suppressant. Some people with inflammatory bowel disease are put on actual immunosuppressants and things that block tumor necrosis factor alpha, and that worries me for a cancer risk. Acicol does not. I'd rather have the person on Acicol for life than have repeated bouts of inflammatory bowel disease,
sure,
because we know that that is a cancer risk. But let's talk a little bit about other things that might be helpful. In the last 2 months, there was an interview talking about inflammatory bowel disease. It's in the archives, and it's, if you just flip back through the last couple of months, and you'll find it. And that would be a good thing for you and your wife to listen to. In that discussion, we talk about the use of probiotics to maintain people in remission, and the doctor gives a little bit of his own personal recipe, which involves use of high-dose omega-3 fatty acids and probiotics, and let's see, Boswellia and a couple of other herbs. And this is a board-certified gastroenterologist who is a scientific researcher and very, very legitimate scientific chops. And he uses that to maintain remission.
Right.
He, you know, gets people into the remission with these drugs. And then once they're there, keeps them there by that and also by modifying their diet. Because it's some people, many people actually, if you have inflammatory bowel disease, during the time that your bowel is inflamed, you have the potential to develop antibodies against various foods because your bowel is irritated. The barrier function of the bowel, which is supposed to keep the food proteins in the intestine until they're broken down into amino acids, that gets disrupted. And so these amino acid chains of 5 or 6 amino acids diffuse across the barrier and are exposed to the lymph cells. And to the lymph cells, they look like bacterial antigens. You know,
right.
10 amino acid chain, that's exactly the sort of thing that bacteria use for a surface marker. And so the immune system says, oh, novel organism, better make antibodies against it. And before you know it, you've got circulating antibodies in your bloodstream against corn or against wheat or against some other substance.
So are you saying then that one would then have the equivalent of having allergic reactions?
Well, not necessarily, but you have immune system activation. You may
right.
not actually have overt allergies. You certainly are unlikely to break out in hives, but it's like a tinderbox down there in the intestine. You've already got the immune system upregulated. You've got antibodies. You've got cytokines. And so it makes it much, much easier to trigger into the inflammatory bowel condition again when you get some stress. So it's kind of like having a lot of dry brush around. Somebody has to light the match, but it's better to clean up the dry brush.
Sure.
What I'm saying really at this point is get it calmed down, listen to that interview, consider getting tested for the antibodies, and I'm talking IgG, very important, not IgE.
IgG?
IgG against common foods. Those tests are available. They are alternative. If you go to your primary care family practice doctor, unless they've been educated outside of the standard path, they're going to order IgE. Because
right.
that's what I was taught to do in residency. IgE will find a certain kind of food allergy, the kind that is anaphylactic, the ones that little kids who get asthma attacks when they eat peanuts.
Sure.
That's the IgE one. But the IgG, which is what I would anticipate a person with inflammatory bowel disease would develop, get blood tested and find out what she should be avoiding dietarily.
That's wonderful.
Okay, good
Thanks.
Luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And let's go to Jim in Felton. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I'm calling to thank you because you didn't prescribe this. I suppose you suggested perhaps an exercise for heel spurs.
Yes.
And I just wanted to tell you that it just really seemed to have helped me a lot, so that I'm just really relieved by your suggestion, and I've been working at it. I do it a little longer than just a few seconds.
Mm-hmm, good.
But just standing on a stair the way you said and letting my heels just kind of naturally drop down seem to, especially early in the day, and then after I work or I'm doing things where I'm on cement a lot or whatever, that along with changing shoes and all, I just wanted to let you know that it was very helpful and I appreciated it so much.
Well, thank you for the feedback. I appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And just to recap what Jim is talking about, heel spurs or plantar fasciitis, the terms are often used interchangeably, is inflammation on the bottom of the foot. And the classic symptom of this is that the bottom of your feet hurt when you get up in the morning. And if you keep walking, you can sort of walk it out and then you're fine until you sit down for a while. And then when you get back up again, so it's foot pain made worse by rest is the classic symptom. And the reason it's made worse by rest is that you're getting swelling and you have to squeeze the swelling out, like squeezing water out of a sponge, and then you no longer have pain until it swells again. The stretch that I talked about was to put your front part of the foot, the toes, up to the ball of the foot on a stairway and slowly let your weight pull the heel down so that your toes are pointing up towards your nose, more or less. And that's generally best held for 15 to 30 seconds. So Jim was right that more than a few seconds is good. And alternating foot to foot, even if you only have the pain on one side, because if you got it on one side, you're likely to develop it on the other side. This is a disease that plagues people as they get older. Our feet lose some of their natural resiliency and flexibility, and that's to be expected, but sometimes has some consequences. There are devices people can get, braces and sleep and things that flex their feet up. That's also helpful. But I find that generally if you'll do this exercise every day, that does take care of it in the majority of cases. The reason that heel spur is used as a designation is because with time and persistent inflammation, people actually develop calcium deposits in the tendon that attaches to the heel, and it shows up on x-ray and it looks like a little rose thorn or a spur. And oddly enough, I think that's not the cause of the pain, but back before we really understood it, we would say, oh, see, you've got a heel spur. We need to remove that. That's what's causing your pain. And of course, surgery is the last thing you want to do. Surgery for pain, always think twice. Sometimes you need it, but it shouldn't be the first move, unless, of course, the pain is from acute appendicitis or something like that. There are no absolute rules in medicine. Funny about that. Let's go to Craig in Seaside. Hello, Craig, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Since you're tired or jet-lagged today, I am 73 years old, and I get tired in the afternoon. I usually get about 6 hours sleep, 7 hours sleep, which is not enough, and I sometimes take a nap. But when I have to do something, like I did yesterday to drive my son to San Jose, I take about 2 o'clock or 1:30, I take 5-hour energy. And I'm able to maintain the safe driving and to get home safely and that. I want to know your opinion of 5-hour energy or if you have one.
Is the ingredient caffeine or guarana?
No, there is no caffeine. There is niacin, vitamin B6, folic acid, vitamin B12, sodium. And then there's an energy blend of taurine, glucino something or other, malic acid, N-acetyl L-tyrosine, and L-phenylalanine, and by God, there is a little caffeine at the bottom.
Uh-huh.
However,
yeah.
I find that I have a very great degree of sensitivity to stimulants because I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic, sober for 25 years, but the fact is, this has not given me, I don't use it regularly or anything like that, but I have had no side effects from it that I know of, and it seems to work very well to do what it claims to do, to allow me to do things which I might not be able to do otherwise.
Well, when you got to that last ingredient, obviously caffeine is a stimulant, and caffeine is, of the things you mentioned, the one that maybe could give you, if you took it in large doses, could give you a problem with a heart rhythm. It doesn't really raise blood pressure, but it definitely can cause your heart to skip beats or something. So the older you are, the more problematic that side effect can be. But it sounds like you're tolerating it well, and none of the other ingredients in there worry me as being inappropriate. So I guess it's a lesson, though, to say you've got to read the entire label to know what's in something. caffeine being relatively strong. For example, when I prescribe taurine for people, I typically will give something like 4,000 milligrams, 2,000 to 4,000 milligrams, whereas a caffeine pill might have 50 milligrams in it. So with caffeine being literally almost 10 times as strong as taurine as a stimulant, you can see how in an ingredient list that is in order of volume, it would be at the bottom of the list. And that's true of a lot of energy drinks and other things. The caffeine and or guarana is really buried there at the bottom of the list. But I don't see a problem with what you're using. I would like to suggest, however, that you consider being tested for sleep apnea, because that is something that is very common in older men and could lead to your drowsiness in the afternoon. And while your stimulant works, I worry a little bit about people who fall asleep in the afternoon that they may be losing brain cells at night because of sleep apnea.
I fortunately have had that test and was not positive for sleep apnea.
I'm glad you got checked. Good.
Yeah, and also I would like to say, but just in general, they told me years ago that most people, there was a study that the people who really got tired during the day, especially in the afternoon, generally had one symptom, and that is not enough sleep.
Yeah, well, that's...
They don't go to bed early enough and they get up to work.
Right. Well, that would make sense. Okay, have a great day.
Thank you, Dr.
Bye-bye. Well, we've got just a few minutes, and we're going to try to talk briefly with Mary Ann in Felton.
All right, how you doing? So I'm just wondering about irritable bowel syndrome, I guess it is.
Uh-huh.
I never really had it before, but I was giving a medication for anti-inflammatory, generic for Voltaren.
Yes.
What happened was I started getting diarrhea and the gas and bloating immediately. Mm-hmm. I tried probiotics, and that seems to be not helping at all. And I'm going to listen to that special that you talked about on June 20th, I think.
June 20th, thank you.
13th.
All right, so your symptoms are bloating? And
well, no, and I have the diarrhea mainly.
Bloating and diarrhea. This started after taking Voltaren, and are you still taking the generic Voltaren?
No, I stopped after 4 tablets.
How long ago was that?
That was July 24th.
Okay, so this really set something in motion.
Yeah.
Do you remember when I was talking about food allergies earlier?
Right, my mom has celiac.
Right, one of the things that is potential trigger, I had mentioned inflammatory bowel disease, people can develop these food reactions, let's call them food antibodies rather than food allergies, to just because the word allergy is understood differently by doctors. So these food reactions, which are antibody-based, can develop anytime there's a loss of the barrier function. And so just your 4 Voltaren could potentially have set something in motion that was sort of primed to go. You may have developed a food sensitivity. And given that your symptoms are persistent, where I would suggest you start is in eliminating the common food antigens from your diet for maybe 3 weeks and continuing on your probiotics, but increasing the dose to about 30 billion organisms a day for a few days. That's actually not that high a dose, but in general, if it's a dysbiosis, just a pure and simple dysbiosis, that will make a dent in the symptoms, and so that will give you a clue that that's what's going on. One of the things these probiotics do at those kinds of doses, 30 to 50 billion organisms, is they calm down the immune system. And so they have a sort of calming effect. It's not just reseeding the ground cover and putting good bacteria in. There's actually a biological effect at those doses that can be beneficial.
Right, yeah, because I've been doing a 12 billion.
Yeah, just take 3 of them.
Oh, okay, yeah, because it just seems like it got worse, but I wasn't.
I would start by taking more, and in terms of the things to eliminate, if you send me a self-addressed stamped envelope here to the station, I'll send you a short list of things. Off the top of my head, it's basically wheat, dairy, corn, soy, peanuts, citrus, and shellfish.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so if you eliminate those things from your diet for 3 weeks, and that means you can still have rice, you can have bread made with rice and pecans or something. I like the rice pecan bread when I'm on an elimination diet, but it'll be a significant shift from what you're used to doing. Oh, and I did say dairy, I hope, on
yes,
that list.
You did.
Yeah. So those are the things That
would is not rice milk then. Or
rice milk's
then.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, just cow's milk. And
but yogurt is okay?
Yogurt's not okay.
It's not okay.
And
okay.
Soy yogurt isn't okay either. Soy milk is not okay because you're eliminating soy. Do it for 3 weeks, and I think symptoms will improve. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.